That intense emotional connection between Benkei and Yoshitsune is raised to a high level of abstraction. Yoshitsune says to Benkei, "Your intelligence at the barrier was beyond human." And Yoshitsune interprets this as a sign that they were favored by a bodhisattva, an enlightened Buddhist being. And Yoshitsune then explains their struggles together in terms of Buddhist philosophy. And the chorus observes, "The master and the followers all remain dazed, just as if awakening from a dream, looking at each other and shedding tears." So instead of seeing Benkei break down on stage, sobbing, instead of this emotional catharsis, in the original version, in the no version of this story, we get both Benkei and Yoshitsune weeping as they contemplate the evanescence of life and the tragedy of karma. So after Ataka, we leave thinking, can Yoshitsune and Benkei transcend the turmoil of this world with all its emotional conflicts? But with Kanjincho, we order another bottle of sake, and we hope that the next play will have even more emotional conflicts. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our quick romp through No and Kabuki. And I hope our discussion has inspired you to watch some, whether live or on DVD. And if it's Kabuki on DVD, please invite some friends over and serve lots of snacks and strong drinks and yell back at the screen, because it'll not only be more fun, it'll even be more historically accurate.
You are listening to Understanding Japan, a Cultural History, produced by the Great Courses in partnership with the Smithsonian Institution. Lecture 13, The Importance of Japanese Gardens.
In Japan, gardens are treated as cultural treasures. They are listed as UNESCO heritage sites. Foreign dignitaries are taken to gardens as a means of showing them Japanese culture. And famous gardens have huge crowds and long lines in the tourist season. Now, all countries have beautiful gardens. England and France have rich garden cultures. But Japanese gardens have a cultural significance that's unusual. So in this lecture, I want to consider Japanese gardens in two ways. First, I want to discuss gardens as part of a history of aesthetics. Why are Japanese gardens designed in a certain way? What concept of beauty lies behind these gardens? But I also want to look at gardens as expressions of broader political and social concerns. So, with both the aesthetic and the social dimensions in mind, let's look back on a millennium or so of Japanese gardens. And let's start with the gardens of the high classical period. A famous example is the garden of the Byodo-in in Uji. Both the buildings and the garden are classic evocations of Heian aesthetics. The Byodo-in was originally a rural villa on the Uji River near Kyoto. Fujiwara no Michinaga, the master of Heian court politics, used it as his meditation retreat. It was converted into a temple in 1052. It's worth considering the gardens and the surviving buildings in their totality, since there's a unity of purpose. In fact, the goal of the designers of the Byodo-in was to create a tiny scale model of the Pure Land, paradise in miniature. As you'll recall, Pure Land Buddhism focused on rebirth in a pure land, created by the monk Amida. People who called out to Amida for help would be reborn in a paradise created for those believers. The largest surviving structure in the Byodo-in complex is a hall dedicated to Amida. It's known alternately as the Amida Hall or the Phoenix Hall. The large statue of Amida inside is considered a national treasure. And the walls of the Amida Hall are covered with angels, a hovering sculpture garden of auspicious figures, all rejoicing in Amida's vow to save every sinner who repents. The Amida Hall is set in a lotus pond, an artificial lake, and this placement is important. Essentially, it makes the Amida Hall an island of salvation. There's a second tiny island next to the Amida Hall, and you can cross a bridge from the Amida Hall to the tiny island and then to the shore. This symbolizes Amida's bridge to the Pure Land. So this garden is one with a clear religious message. Another superb example of this type of classical garden can be found hundreds of miles to the northeast in Hiraizumi at a temple called Motsuji. Motsuji was originally a large temple complex built by the northern branch of the powerful Fujiwara house. All the original temple buildings were lost in a fire in the 1200s. But the overall landscape architecture of the ponds is largely unchanged. In its original layout, Motsuji had the same major buildings as the Byodo-in, a main prayer hall set on a quiet lake and a bridge to a small island and then a bridge to the shore. Those bridges have not been rebuilt, but the layout is clear. The garden is famous for two groups of rock formations and a tiny sandy beach. Those features are miniature replicas of real landscapes, such as the craggy seacoast of northeastern Japan. So the lakeshore represents, in miniature, the entire world with a huge range of landscapes. So visitors enter the complex and then leave the world behind by crossing a bridge to the small island and then crossing another bridge and arriving at the main temple building. That path was an analogy for Amida's saving power, which moves us from this ordinary world to paradise. Now, like the Byodo-in, Motsuji had something of a dual role, as a religious site and as an aristocratic villa. And each year in May, there's a reenactment of a Heian-era garden party. Reenactors in Heian court dress sit on mats by a gentle stream, and they indulge in a favored Heian pastime. Sake is floated down the stream, and the revelers need to compose a poem appropriate to the occasion before it's their turn to drink. Now, that is either a taste of heaven or perhaps a taste of hell, all depending on your attitudes towards the impromptu composition of poetry. But let's move forward in time to medieval gardens and medieval aesthetics. One of the most imitated gardens in Japan is the garden at Saihoji in Kyoto. It's also one of the hardest to visit. You need to apply in advance and to copy sutras, and that's all to reduce the volume of visitors. Saihoji is also known colloquially as Kokedera, or Moss Temple, because the gardens are famous for rich, verdant moss. Ironically, where there is now moss, there was once raked sand. The exact origins of the Saihoji gardens are unclear, but the current layout reflects the influence of the monk Musō Soseki. Soseki converted the site from a Pure Land temple to a Zen temple in the 1300s. So originally the garden was probably a paradise garden. But in its redesign, it no longer directly represents the paradise theme. Instead, the garden offers ever-changing perspectives. There's a new view from each step in the path. Second, Saihoji has the prototype of a Japanese rock garden, a clump of rocks commonly thought to suggest a waterfall. Now, Musson Soseki was an influential monk in his own right, and his garden designs were widely imitated. Perhaps the most famous garden influenced by Saihōji is at Kinkakuji, the Temple of the Golden Pavilion in Kyoto. The Golden Pavilion was built at the end of the 14th century by the third Ashikaga shogun, Ashikaga Yoshimitsu. He used it as a villa, but after his death, it became a Zen temple known as Roku-onji. Now, the garden at Kinkakuji, like the garden at Mōtsuji, uses large stones to create the illusion of a much larger landscape seen from a distance. The small lake seems like a vast sea with a rocky shore. But, like Saihōji, there's no longer a bridge to paradise. The original Pure Land Buddhist element is gone. And the emphasis is instead on changing perspectives. There are points where the main building, the Golden Pavilion, dominates the landscape, and others where it almost disappears in favor of small rocky islands or a wooded grove. And behind this aesthetic is something conceptual. Instead of the Pure Land emphasis on a journey to the Pure Land, there's a nod to the Zen notion of extreme subjectivity. How we see the world can change radically based on our state of mind. If we're optimistic or pessimistic, angry or sad, the same things will look differently based on that attitude. And Zen gardens highlight that idea by letting us see strikingly different worlds just by walking a few steps or turning our heads. Now, in addition to the gardens that surround it, the pavilion at Kinkakuji is also worthy of our attention. In fact, it tells us a great deal about its patron, Ashikaga Yoshimitsu. Remember, Yoshimitsu was the most powerful shogun in a weak dynasty, and his power stemmed from his ability to flatter and cajole the imperial court, and also to flatter and intimidate other warriors. Moreover, as a patron of culture, he relied on trade with Ming China for income. Well, we can see all of these aspects of Yoshimitsu's rule in the design of the Golden Pavilion. It was completed around 1397, and it incorporates three distinct styles. The first floor is laid out like a Heian-era aristocratic villa, like the Byodo Inn. Heian residences were mostly open spaces, separated by wooden screens. So this is Yoshimitsu's nod to his position in Kyoto aristocratic life. But the second floor is in the style of a warrior residence. That layout featured floors with bamboo matting, called tatami, and sliding doors called shoji. That style is now what most Japanese think of as traditional Japanese architecture. So this second floor is Yoshimitsu as shogun. He's literally stacking his position as a warrior on top of his position as a courtier. And then, the tiny third floor is in the style of a Chinese Zen temple, with distinctive arch windows. So this is Yoshimitsu as a patron of high culture and a supporter of Zen Buddhism. So we have one building that blends three different styles, and it reflects Yoshimitsu's syncretic approach to politics. He knew that he had to work all the angles to maintain power, simultaneously styling himself as a warrior, a courtier, and a patron of the arts. And the syncretism of Kinkakuji, the combination of distinct cultural elements, is considered a centerpiece of medieval aesthetics. And so is the gaudiness of Kinkakuji. Note, for example, the opulence of the gold leaf on the second and third floors of the pavilion. The term basara, now rather obscure, referred to the conspicuously outlandish design. The best counterpart in modern English might be to refer to a man as a dandy. It's mostly a term of praise, but it also carries the connotation of flashy and ostentatious. But there's also a countervailing aesthetic in medieval design, towards the austere and towards the simple. In landscape architecture, the great example of this is the emergence of temple rock gardens. The term in Japanese is karesansui, or dry landscaping. Two iconic rock gardens are the Abbot's Gardens at Daisen Inn and at Ryo-anji. Both date from the 1400s or the 1500s in their original layout, and both have been attributed to the famous painter So-ami. Now, both of these gardens have changed over the years, and there's a vigorous debate over which elements were added later. Some research suggests that the garden at Ryo-anji, for example, was rebuilt extensively in the 1700s. So it's actually not so much a medieval garden as an early modern recreation of a medieval garden. But all of those quibbles aside, there are two distinctive innovations in these gardens. First, the concept of dry landscaping itself, using raked gravel or moss to represent water, and using stones to represent such features as mountains and bridges, and in the extreme case of the rock garden at Ryo-anji, the only plants are moss. Second, these gardens are incredibly compact in size. The rock garden at Daisen Inn is L-shaped. It bends around a corner of the abbot's residence. It's about 30 feet by 40 feet, with the most important features squeezed into a corner, an area about 10 feet by 10 feet. Now, this tiny garden has generated an outsized volume of interpretation. The most basic is that the tall, upright stones represent mountains. The rake sand is a rushing stream. The long horizontal stone is a bridge over the stream. Another stone in the adjacent garden is supposed to represent a boat floating in a rushing stream. In that interpretation, the genius of the garden is that it takes a scene from classic monochrome Chinese landscape painting with a waterfall rushing out of the mountains and converts it into a garden and shrinks it to a tiny scale, all while somehow invoking the grandeur of a spectacular vista. There are much more esoteric interpretations, though. Some argue, for example, that the tall upright stones at Daisen Inn are not simply mountains, but highly stylized images of the Buddha, and that the smaller stones around these are actually protector deities. The same debate rages over the meditation garden at Ryo-anji, which consists of 15 stones surrounded by raked gravel. An early description of the garden at Ryo-anji talks about rocks representing a tiger swimming with her cubs. Another reading of the rocks is that they are islands in a sea. Now, many have noticed that it's impossible to see all 15 stones in the Ryo-anji garden from any one angle. And that reinforces the Zen belief in the limits of the senses. Looking at the garden reminds the viewer that they are only seeing a fragment of what is really there. Now, because so much about these gardens is speculative, including the history of the design changes, I don't want to run wild with these interpretations. But these two gardens are Zen temples, so it's worth highlighting the contrast between a Zen garden and a Pure Land Paradise garden. The Paradise garden is supposed to represent paradise. In other words, it represents paradise to our senses. But by contrast, in a Zen garden, we are reminded that that naive reliance on our senses will actually impede our progress towards enlightenment. Instead, we want to be reminded of how unreliable our senses are. So even if the garden is beautiful, perhaps it should also be a little bit perplexing. Another important innovation of the 1500s is the tea garden, a special style of garden leading to a small tea house. But to understand the tea garden, we need to know a little bit about the Japanese tea ceremony. So let's take a little detour and loop through the history and the aesthetics of the Japanese tea ceremony before turning to the tea garden itself. Tea drinking in Japan seems to have begun with monks who brought tea back from China. But by the 1300s, tea drinking had become an important social occasion. Warriors would hold large parties and put out all their finery, not just fine teacups, but fine rugs and trays and tables. And these lavish parties were part of that ostentation, that basara of the medieval era. Now in the 1500s, tea drinking became more structured and more formal. And lords began to entrust the details of these parties to tea masters. In modern parlance, tea masters were a combination of protocol officers, etiquette masters, and event planners. Now, it's difficult to discuss tea ceremony because there is such a large and rich literature on the subject. And some of that literature is completely overwrought. For example, one of the earliest serious books on Japanese aesthetics, in English, was about tea. The Book of Tea by Okakura Kakuzo, published in 1906. Okakura considered tea ceremony to be the essence of Japanese culture. He called it a philosophy that encompassed ethics, religion, economics, and, in his words, moral geometry. Now, I would encourage you to read Okakura's book. It's just wonderful. But I would disagree that tea ceremony is the essence of Japanese culture and philosophy. What I would say instead is that it is an important reflection of Japanese aesthetics. First, tea ceremony involves graceful and stylized movements. The tea master should enter the room, sit and prepare the tea, serve the tea, all without a single wasted motion. Every move should be graceful and pleasing. We see this in other Japanese art forms, like no theater. Second, the tea house itself and the implements, they are commonly simple, without ornamentation. A tea house is not the place for elaborate gold leaf. Rather, an ideal tea implement is a simple bamboo whisk or a water ladle. The clean lines have a form follows function beauty rather than a rococo ornamental beauty. A perfect cup for tea ceremony could be a little bit lumpy, maybe a dull earth tone, and therefore it's all the more beautiful to those who are aesthetically attuned to the simplicity of the overall ceremony. And here's a third way that the tea ceremony reflects Japanese aesthetics in general. The ideal tea house is somewhat cramped, which creates a feeling of intimacy. The interior might be decorated with a single flower and a single hanging scroll. But the key idea is that less is more. And these elements of Japanese aesthetics, simplicity, natural materials, clean lines, functional elements, these values have historically dovetailed with certain Western aesthetic movements, the English arts and crafts movement, the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. Steve Jobs of Apple had a long-standing Zen practice. And while there are no bamboo mats, Steve Jobs himself linked his emphasis on clean, simple functionality to Japanese aesthetics. Okay, with these remarks on the tea ceremony in mind, let's now return to the tea garden itself. What's the function of this garden? Well, essentially, it's supposed to lead you into the almost meditative space of the tea ceremony. So an ideal tea garden has carefully placed stepping stones. The walk should be peaceful and moist, but not muddy. So moss is good. The palette of the planting should be muted. Evergreens are ideal. Bold flowers and bold colors, not good. So plum blossoms are nice because they have such a muted, subtle blossom. Maple is okay, a little red amidst the green, but cherry is, by all classic manuals, a definite no-no, just too flashy for a tea garden. Now, many famous gardens are actually fusions of multiple styles. For example, the gardens of Jishoji, more commonly known as Ginkakuji, the Temple of the Silver Pavilion. The Silver Pavilion was built for Shogun Ashikaga Yoshimasa, the grandson of Ashikaga Yoshimitsu. And there's a wonderful contrast between the bold assertiveness of the Golden Pavilion as compared to the somber muted tones of the Silver Pavilion. And that's fitting because Yoshimitsu was the most powerful shogun in the Ashikaga dynasty, while Yoshimasa presided over the collapse of the shogunate into civil war. In many ways, Ginkakuji's muted pavilion anticipates the small scale and the design of tea houses. It has a strolling garden around a lake, but it's most famous for a gravel garden, a smooth mound of gravel, and a long raised sand plain. The combination of those two is said to look like a mountain by the sea. Now, Ginkakuji was built in the 1400s, and this gravel garden was almost certainly not a part of the original design. According to one account, when the garden pond was dredged many years after the initial construction, the dirt was piled up, and the garden designer had a brainstorm to cover the dredged mud with gravel. But the net effect of these layers of design and redesign is that Ginkakuji is now like three gardens in one. A garden inspired by Saihoji, a quasi-tea garden, and a rock garden. Now, some of the most famous gardens in Japan are called strolling gardens or tour gardens. These gardens can actually combine multiple elements, and they might have more than one tea house. Strolling gardens are often grand in scale, but they use elements from small-scale gardens. The idea is to pack multiple perspectives into the space. A fine example of a strolling garden is Katsura Rikkyu in Kyoto, known in English as Katsura Imperial Villa or Katsura Detached Palace. It was built mostly in the 1600s for a prince, Toshihito, the younger brother of Emperor Go-Yōzei. Toshihito's garden is not astonishingly original, but it's a fantastic combination of the elements we've discussed so far. It has two beautiful shoin, or drawing rooms. That's the style of the Silver Pavilion at Ginkakuji, and also of the middle floor of the Golden Pavilion. Ginkakuji. Katsura Rikkyu also has four surviving tea houses. Each of those four tea houses has a separate path, and each path hides most of the garden until you reach the tea house, at which point a final vista is revealed. But each vista is unique to that tea house. In addition, we find a famous example of borrowed scenery at Katsura Rikkyu. There's a gravel promontory that leads out to a lantern, beyond which are two small islands connected by a stone bridge, beyond which is a tea house. The effect is twofold. First, it suggests a famous view from Amano Hashidate on the Japan seacoast. And second, it makes the tea house look far away, although it's not. And that's exactly how a tour garden should function. So let me close with a contrast between Japanese and Western gardens, specifically between the gardens at Versailles and Katsura Rikkyu. While this contrast is not original, it's informative. When you visit Versailles, what's your general impression? Well, it has lots of straight lines and right angles, lots of clear, broad vistas. The human effort required to build and maintain Versailles is obvious. It's obvious in the fountains, the exact shape of the shrubs. The garden is nature bent to man's design, the natural world conforming to the power of the king or the power of the state. There's something very different going on at Casa de Rikiu. Instead of broad vistas, you have an ever-changing perspective. Indeed, there are not many gardens in Japan where you can walk 50 feet and see pretty much the same thing. In much the same way, many have observed Japanese gardens look more natural than nature itself. Now, it's tempting here to make a grand generalization about philosophy in the East versus philosophy in the West, but let me instead make a more limited observation about Japanese aesthetics. Often the goal in Japanese aesthetics is to hide human effort rather than to extol it. And in gardens, that means invoking nature rather than coercing it. Japanese gardens avoid hard right angles. They avoid unnatural forms. You want natural elements to suggest and invoke still grander natural elements. A rock suggesting an island, for example. Well, we've certainly covered a lot of ground today. Along the way, I hope you've gained some insights that will heighten your appreciation of Japanese gardens, whether you tour them virtually or physically.
Lecture 14, The Meaning of Bushido in a Time of Peace.
Today we're going to talk about one of the most misunderstood yet famous aspects of Japanese culture, the origins of Bushido. As you may know, Bushido means the way of the warrior. The suffix do means way. So, for example, judo literally means the gentle way. Now, the topic of Bushido is so rife with misinformation that one of my colleagues wrote an article called Bushido or Bull. And while there is such a thing as Bushido, let's start by clearing away some of the bull. For example, strictly speaking, the term Bushido was obscure until the 1890s. And that's about 20 years after the samurai class had been dissolved. In fact, the term Bushido was first used in a book written in English by a Japanese Christian who was trying to explain Japan to Americans. So, strictly speaking, the samurai estate never practiced Bushido because the term was obscure until after the dissolution of the warrior class. Now, being slightly less strict on the exact wording, if we accept the terms bushi, which means warrior, and budo, which means the way of combat, and shido, which means the way of the gentleman, then we can conclude that people who were talking about budo and shido and bushi, they were talking about bushido even if they didn't use that exact word. But even with that allowance, we are left with a paradox. Samurai began writing about the way of the samurai, Bushido, primarily during peacetime. The Tokugawa shogunate had suppressed the insurrection at Shimabara in 1638. And after that, there was no fighting for over 200 years. But there was writing about samurai culture. So almost all our descriptions of warrior conduct were written after warfare had stopped. And that's one of the striking tensions in virtually all works on Bushido. They are nostalgic. They are looking back to an age that is slipping away. Or they confront the paradox of warriors at peace, and they try to find a new role for the samurai. So here's an example. Miyamoto Musashi's famous work, The Book of Five Rings. It's a guide to strategy, and especially swordsmanship. And Musashi was indeed a seasoned warrior, a great swordsman and tactician. But the book was written around 1645, when Miyamoto Musashi was about 60. He had fought on the losing side in the wars between the Toyotomi and the Tokugawa clans, and thereafter he had wandered Japan as a ronin, a masterless samurai. However, after 60 duels, Musashi became known as a master swordsman, and he was politically rehabilitated. He fought on the Tokugawa side at Shimabara, and he became a swordsmanship instructor for Kumamoto Domain. By the 1640s, he suffered from a variety of ailments, and according to some accounts, he retreated to a mountain cave to practice Buddhist meditation and write the Book of Five Rings. So the text is a combination of memoir and manual. It's full of practical advice on how to duel, such as don't try to jump in a swamp. But these are mixed with somewhat mystical aphorisms, such as compose your body and mind in a straightforward way so that you can bend and warp the mind of your opponent, thereby achieving victory by twisting and distorting his mind. Now, what's intriguing about a text like the Book of Five Rings is that even the practical advice on dueling is largely impractical, because neither the shogunate nor the daimyo were willing to tolerate that sort of lawlessness, the lawlessness that comes with vendettas and feuding. In fact, in the early modern period, both the shogunate and the domains relied on a principle called kenka ryosebai, which dictated that in case of a fight, both parties could be punished for disturbing the peace. So, practically speaking, virtually no one applied Miyamoto's lessons outside of a martial arts dojo, a training place. Because by the time he wrote the Book of Five Rings, there was no officially sanctioned violence. Another book that's sometimes described as a handbook for samurai is Yamamoto Tsunetomo's work, Hagakure. That's sometimes translated as Hidden in the Leaves. If you would do a basic web search on Hagakure, or even just read the blurbs on the back of a modern paperback edition, you will find it described as the essential book of the samurai. It's a manual for the samurai class. It's a cornerstone of samurai literature. And the only problem with these descriptions is that they are completely wrong. Just completely wrong. Hagakure is not a manual. It's not a long-revered guide to samurai practice. And it's not an insight into how most samurai lived. So what is it? Well, basically, Hagakure is sort of a grouchy and petulant memoir, and a lot of it is deeply contradictory. Let me give you an example. The most famous line in Hagakure is found in the opening chapter. The way of the warrior is found in death. This is widely quoted as central to samurai thought. It's a cornerstone of the samurai code. And the problem with that interpretation is that, unlike Miyamoto Musashi, Yamamoto Tsunetomo had no practical combat experience of any kind. First, he was born in 1659, after warfare had ended. He never saw anything remotely resembling combat. Second, he was a scribe by profession. That is not a profession with a big risk of sudden death. There weren't a lot of deadly calligraphic accidents, even in wartime. And third, He was mostly unemployed. His work as a scribe was erratic. And although he did have personal contact with his lord, his daimyo, he never held an important position for more than a year or two. So Hagakure is the morose late-life reflections of an armchair general. In fact, what's most interesting about Hagakure is how Yamamoto is deeply nostalgic for a world that had already ended before his birth. He's saying goodbye to an age of which he was never really a part. For example, Yamamoto notes that men are getting too womanly. Samurai get together and they talk about sex and clothes and money, whereas in the good old days, samurai were frugal and tidy, and every morning they would scrub and groom themselves. They'd make sure their armor was polished so that if they died in battle, they would leave behind a nice-smelling and good-looking corpse. None of this makes any sense in the early 1700s, when Yamamoto is dictating the reminiscences that would become Hagakure. In fact, Hagakure isn't even a reminiscence. It's nostalgia for what Yamamoto imagined his father's world was like, or maybe his grandfather's world was like. Now, this eccentric book was largely forgotten for two centuries. The first modern edition of Hagakure was published in 1900. And the introduction notes that it is an extremely rare book. It's very difficult to find a copy. And even after the publication of this edition, in the first decade of the 20th century, a total of only 3 Japanese language books mention Hagakure, either in the table of contents or in the book title. But in the 1940s, the number of books discussing Hagakure soared to 35, with 24 books in 1942 alone. Do you see the pattern? Hagakure really only becomes the book of the samurai during the Pacific War. In fact, interest peaks right after Pearl Harbor. So it actually has very little to do with samurai tradition. If by samurai tradition we mean what samurai actually did and thought. Instead, it's a good example of what the Japanese army thought Japanese soldiers should think samurai did. So all in all, I find Hagakure a rather perverse work. But there is a sense in which Yamamoto's work is historically valuable. And this is because his frustration is part of a larger cultural shift. He was struggling to understand how a samurai should behave in the absence of war. And so the quixotic passages of Yamamoto's work are actually quite revealing. The book contains many strange and even confusing jumps, from the need for courage and resolution to a passage about how to properly receive a letter, and then a detailed discussion of how not to yawn. And I think that confusion is the best thing about the book, because by the late 1600s and the early 1700s, samurai were genuinely wondering what they were supposed to be doing. They faced a truly significant question. How do you maintain a warrior class in the absence of war? Now, a much better answer to this question came from a scholar named Yamaga Sokol. Yamaga was an influential Tokugawa thinker. He wrote about Bushi and Shido. But unlike Yamamoto Tsunetomo, he was taken seriously in his own lifetime. Yamaga was born in 1622, and he studied with one of the leading Confucian scholars of his day. And he turned to Confucianism to explain why the samurai, as a warrior elite, should stay in power even in the absence of war. Now, in an ideal society, in an ideal Confucian society, the Chinese vision was that the country is ruled by the emperor and administered by an impartial landed gentry. And because they are landed, they have the time to study. And because they study the Confucian classics, they are moral. And so they administer the realm and advise the emperor with wisdom and impartiality. So, who might in Japan be the counterparts to this noble gentry? Well, of course, it's the samurai. The samurai used to be warriors, and they once ruled as a warrior class, but now, during peacetime, it seems like they have nothing to do. However, according to Yamaga, it's a noble Confucian nothing to do. Samurai reflect on great Confucian moral problems, like, how can I be loyal to my lord, so loyal that my own servants follow my example and are loyal to me? Or how can I be such a devoted son to my parents that my children are dutiful based on my example? And in Yamaga's view, since samurai are thinking about this so often, they themselves become intensely moral. And therefore, it's only natural that they should be the ruling class in Japan. Because who else could be so impartial in justice and in administration? Now, this is a clever intellectual move. In Hagakure, Yamamoto's theory is that in peacetime, a scribe should always be ready for death in combat, which is very strange. Whereas Yamaga says, use your leisure as an opportunity for moral cultivation, and that way you can earn your elite status. And Yamaga's thought was deeply influential. Although, in practice, being a moral exemplar could be quite challenging for the samurai. In fact, here's a stickler. Yamaga elevated the virtue of loyalty. But how do you show great loyalty in peacetime? Well, this was a question that the samurai of the early modern period really wrestled with. And nowhere was the thorniness of this question more apparent than in the famous vendetta of the 47 Ronin. This was a shocking historical event. It engaged all the major scholars of the day, and as soon as the censors would allow, it was turned into a kabuki play, and it's never left popular culture. There have been at least 39 film versions, starting in 1908, and at least 34 TV versions of the story, and also an opera and a ballet. So what's the story? Well, let's start with the historical event. In 1701, the Tokugawa shogun in Edo was preparing to receive an envoy from the emperor in Kyoto, bearing New Year's greetings. This event was entirely ceremonial. But since it involved the emperor and the shogun, correct protocol was essential. A shogunal officer named Kira Yoshinaka was in charge of protocol, and the daimyo Asano Naganori was in the receiving party. Now, depending on your version of the events, either Lord Kira was corrupt and cruel, and he expected to receive gifts, basically bribes, from Lord Asano, or the alternative version was that Asano was violent and uncouth. But in either case, the two men did not get along. And towards the end of the multi-day reception of the imperial envoys at the shogun's castle, Asano flew into a rage and he tried to kill Kira. He cut him across the face, but he was restrained before he could kill him. Now, Lord Kira recovered, but Asano's conduct was so outrageous that he was ordered to commit seppuku, ritual suicide, and his entire territory was seized by the shogunate as punishment. His lineage lost their land, and all his samurai now became ronin. But here is where the story gets really interesting. Kira suspected that Asano samurai would try to avenge him. But Asano's men were patient. They waited almost 2 years. And then in the last days of 1702, the soon-to-be-famous 47 Ronin attacked Kira's compound in Edo. They killed him. They took his head. They went to their lord's grave. They presented the head to their lord. And then they surrendered to the police. Now, the vendetta posed a problem for Tokugawa law because the samurai were both heroes and criminals. As criminals, they had committed murder. And what's worse, they had killed a shogunal officer. But as heroes, they had upheld the highest principle of samurai morality. They had remained loyal to their lord even when there was no chance of worldly gain. They were loyal for the sake of loyalty itself. And the shogunate took 2 months to debate what to do with these ronin, even though the details of the case were not in question. In the end, the shogun ruled that the ronin should commit seppuku. That was the most honorable form of execution. And the general consensus was that the 47 ronin had struck an exact balance between their duty to avenge their lord and their obligation to respect the laws of their lord's lord, the shogun. So the incident became a famous example of Tokugawa-era samurai loyalty. There were, however, dissents on both sides. Yamamoto Tsunetomo, the author of Hagakure, insisted that the ronin had been too cautious. What if Lord Kira had died while the ronin were waiting? It would have been better, he insisted, to attack immediately, even if there had been no chance of killing Lord Kira. A futile attack would have been better than the ronin's caution. And that opinion is a great example of why Hagakure should be read as an eccentric work. Another account critical of the ronin accused them of ambition. Sure, their vendetta looked like martyrdom, but they surrendered to the police instead of immediately committing seppuku once their vendetta was accomplished. So clearly, they were hoping for a pardon, and then maybe a great job. So they were actually careerists. A completely opposite opinion was that the ronin were exemplary because of how they carefully separated their personal grievance from respect for public order. They reportedly had men at the ready to put out fires, just in case Lord Kira's mansion was set ablaze during the attack. So they were determined to uphold the spirit of shogunal law, maintaining public peace. And some even quietly grumbled that the entire incident was set in motion by the shogunate itself, because one of the key principles of Tokugawa law was kinka ryosebai. Both parties to an altercation are guilty of disturbing the peace. So what about Lord Kira? Remember, if he really provoked Asano to fury with cruel words, then that made him a party to the dispute. True, he didn't draw his own weapon, but shouldn't he have been punished in some way? Now, as I mentioned, this incident went viral, so to speak, and playwrights tried to dramatize it almost immediately. The first version that got past the censors is from 1748. It was originally for Bunraku, puppet theater, but it was quickly adapted for kabuki. And ever since then, the incident has been a source of fascination and inspiration to Japanese artists and audiences alike. So the story of the 47 Ronin set up iconic standards for samurai behavior. Brave, stoic, self-sacrificing, even violent when needed, but only as violent as absolutely required out of respect for the broader social order. But it's all for theoretical and dramatic power. That vision of the samurai is not especially good policy, because by the 1700s, most daimyo were not especially interested in spectacular shows of loyalty. On the contrary, after several generations of peace, they were primarily interested in maintaining high levels of conspicuous consumption. The former rivalries of the battlefield had become rivalries of wealth. So daimyo wanted samurai who could arrange a steady or even increasing stream of income, but without oppressive taxation. That might provoke peasants into revolt. So samurai sought to serve their lords by introducing alternative crops, things beyond rice, things that could be sold in Osaka or Edo, cotton, sugar, wax fruit, anything that might bring in more revenue. Now, the paradox of Tokugawa life is that at some level, everyone knew this. But in order to distinguish samurai from merchants, it was somehow essential to elevate samurai service. Now, at the margins, some thinkers began saying that samurai were basically employees. They worked for their daimyo. But few people wanted to say this out loud. So, for the samurai, the early modern period was a time of change and even social ambiguity. And to illustrate that, I'd like to close with one of the most remarkable examples of the way the samurai class adapted to new realities. So let's travel to the domain of Yonezawa in northern Japan, where for almost three generations in the early 1600s, everything went wrong for the Uesugi house. In the 1590s, the Uesugi were at the peak of their power, with holdings of over 1 million koku. Daimyo measure their wealth in terms of the annual rice harvest, and 1 million koku is the equivalent of about 5 million bushels of rice. The Uesugi were also members of the council entrusted with advising Toyotomi Hideyoshi's heir. But because they opposed Tokugawa Ieyasu, they were reduced from 1 million koku to 300,000 koku. Then in the 1660s, the Uesugi daimyo died suddenly of appendicitis, and that was without having secured Tokugawa approval of his will. So by Tokugawa law, he was intestate. And the Tokugawa almost seized all Uesugi land. But in the end, they were reduced to about 150,000 koku, almost a 90% drop from their peak. So, for generations, and by Tokugawa design, the Uesugi were financially strained. When they lost their land, they lost their means of supporting their samurai. And while they did shrink the number of vassals, they always had too many. Just too many samurai mouths to feed. And so they struggled. Until the late 1700s, when the Uesugi decided to bring a dark secret into the open. Samurai were working on the side. Samurai men and women were doing handicrafts in their homes. Now, as shocking as this revelation might have been, the Yonezawa government decided to formally embrace this new reality. They set up an official system where samurai households could get looms, and they told merchants to let samurai sell their cloth discreetly, entering through a side entrance so they wouldn't be seen buying and selling like commoners. The government also issued an edict declaring that it was not shameful for samurai families to have buy employments. It was noble and essential. The only thing that was shameful was weaving badly. In fact, the Yonezawa government explicitly invoked samurai honor in promoting weaving. They said, "Your samurai ancestors, they served us in battle, and they did so with honor. And today, you can serve us by weaving. And the quality of the cloth that you sell to the government office, that is a measure of your honor." And so these reforms led to something remarkable in Yonezawa. The domain became famous for a distinctive type of cloth, a blend of silk and linen. It was sold with a special seal, genuine Yonezawa cloth, except no substitutes. And samurai households in Yonezawa became known as their lord's weavers. Now, the extent of this transformation in Yonezawa was unique, but it points to the great flexibility of the notion of samurai. The term